the gospel message that we are to shine throughout the world is, it's hard for a lot of people to believe it. They struggle with understanding it and what they should apply. And so any doubts that there may be in the Word, we need to eliminate. Because if someone has a question about a scripture, we need to be able to tell them what it means. And so there's a passage in Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 20, that we need to be able to understand and we need to be able to talk to people about. Because there are people that want these verses to be ignored. And it's just not people saying verbally. In most of our Bibles that you'll find in the world today, there will be some kind of a notation about these verses. And so whatever version you're looking at, I'm pretty sure you're going to find a note or some kind of a notation about these verses. And so we have to understand what it means and why these notes are there. And can we ignore the notes, or can we ignore the verses themselves? The King James has no notification whatsoever. That is one Bible that if you have, you would not know that there was any dispute about the authenticity of these verses. It simply provides them without comment, as it does pretty much every other verse in its translation. Now, the New King James has a note at the end of verse 20, which reads, verses 9 through 20 are bracketed in NU as not original. They are lacking in Codex Sinaiticus, Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus, although nearly all other manuscripts of Mark contain them. Now, like most of us here, I'm not really familiar with what the NU reference meant in that note, but the NU text says these variations from the traditional text generally represent the Alexandrian or Egyptian type of text described previously in the New Testament text. They are found in the critical text published in the 27th edition of the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament, that's the N, and the United Bible Society's 4th edition, that's the U, and then they have the acronym New Text. The English Standard puts double brackets on it and puts a statement in the text itself saying some of the earliest manuscripts do not include 16, 9 through 20. And the new the NIV also has a statement that reads, the earliest and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark chapter 16, 9 through 20. Now, these last two major versions really cause some confusion, the ones I'm going to talk about now. The New Revised Standard Version has two endings written into the text. There's a shorter ending in double brackets, and then there's a longer ending, which is also in double brackets. And in the margin, there's an explanation. Now, this is where you kind of can get confused. That statement says, some of the most ancient authorities bring the book to a close at the end of verse 8. One authority concludes the book with the shorter ending. Others include the shorter ending and then continue with verses 9 through 20. In most authorities, verses 9 through 20 follow immediately after verse 8, though in some of these authorities, the passage is marked as being doubtful. That's pretty clear as mud, isn't it, what we're finding there? And then, while it gives maybe the fullest explanation, it's not a very clear one. And then the NASB wants to have their cake and eat it too. I suppose they don't want to upset anyone, so they just put the text in brackets like most of the others, but then in the margin reads, later manuscripts add verses 9 through 20. But then at the end of the verses, they have another short ending in brackets and italics, and this footnote says, a few late manuscripts and versions contain this paragraph, usually after verse 8. A few have it at the end of the chapter. So we immediately have to wonder, with all these discrepancies and all these different thoughts about these verses, we have to have a solid understanding of whether we can ignore these verses or whether they are part of the biblical canon and they must be included and they must not be in doubt. And so that's what we have to understand. Can we trust these passages when we read it? And so let us begin with some external evidences first. Many of the early scholars support the inclusion of this passage. The writings of Tatian and Irenaeus support the inclusion of these verses. Justin Martyr in AD 150 refers to Mark 16:20, So there's an early scholar referring to it, so it was obviously in support of the inclusion of this passage, because to him, only, you know, less than 100 years away from the account probably being written, was referencing it and supporting it. Now, there are other translations of the passage in the Latin, in the Syriac, and the Coptic versions, and they do also include these verses in their translations. Almost every manuscript we have today has 9 through 20. So we have to ask ourselves, well then why is this still under dispute? So when we begin to examine further, we find out that there are two early manuscripts which do not have the section. That's the Sinaiticus and the Vinaticus. Those are the two manuscripts that people reference that do not include these verses. And then there's another manuscript called, very mysterious, Manuscript K. It also does not have it. And so there's a 5th century Armenian manuscript that do not include it. There's three different ones of those. So among all the thousands of the manuscripts that we have that include Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 20, we have these, 6 translations that do not. And that's what most people pin their notes on, are these 6, and ignoring the thousands of others that do include it. But what scholars tell us is that these two oldest manuscripts that we have, the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, they don't have it, and so that's what they're saying. Since they're older, they should be trusted and relied upon more often. But they don't want to tell you some facts. The scribe who copied the Vaticanus left some space at the end of Mark chapter 16, after verse 8. Space in the manuscript, where there wasn't spaces left after any other parts of that book or any others in the Vaticanus. And it's generally thought that that person intended to go back and put 9 through 20, but maybe was waiting for another scholar to finish up a translation or so forth. But that gap there indicates that it was meant to go in there, but perhaps just absentmindedly, or just the copywriter didn't do their job very well, and they didn't look over and notice that those verses were missing. And so that leaves enough space where that verse could have gone in. But even further, we should place our emphasis, why should we place our emphasis on these two manuscripts that don't have them? Well, why should we trust these two manuscripts when we find that the Sinaiticus has over 2,877 omissions in the Gospels alone compared to some of these other texts, and the Vaticanus has 3,455 other omissions in the Gospels? And so we should not be placing such emphasis on obviously flawed manuscripts. Even further, these two manuscripts come from Egypt, where there is a Gnostic influence in that region, and during the 1st of the 4th century, many Gnostics were modifying the passages in their manuscripts to kind of fit their worldview. And so this would have been these verses, and of course we haven't really even read the verses yet, but the verses are something that would go against their worldview. And so they are kind of doing their own editing. But scholars also believe that there are many problems with the text itself, so much that they just discard these verses. So in the rest of our time, I'd like for us to look at Mark 16 and see if there are any contradictions that we should be following along with some of these scholars that say it should be ignored. The first point of question is found in verse 14. Here we read that Jesus rebuked their unbelief and hardness of heart because they did not believe those who had seen him after he has risen. Now this is the difference from the other Gospels. We don't read of Jesus rebuking the disciples after his resurrection. So here is a claim discrepancy from the other Gospels. But I do think we need to make a point that the Gospels do teach us that the disciples did doubt and have questions about the risen Jesus, and they were questioning whether he really truly had arisen from the dead. In Matthew 28 verse 17, we read that they did doubt. And in Luke 24:11, the disciples didn't believe the words of the women who had come back from the grave and had said they had seen that the tomb was empty. And they didn't believe them. So there was doubting recorded in other Gospels. And Jesus had previously rebuked them for their lack of belief. We talked about this morning that that there were many occasions where Jesus was foretelling his death, and yet they struggled with that. They had doubts about what he had been telling them. And so this would not be such a stretch of the imagination that even when faced with a risen Christ, they still might have that doubt in them that where he would need to rebuke them. So that's not very much of a contradiction at all. In verses 17 through 18, we read of many signs that would accompany the believers. And we read that they would be able to cast out demons, they would be able to speak with new tongues, they would be able to take up serpents, drink deadly drinks, and lay their hands on the sick. Now this is another instance where scholars tell us that the internal evidence of this passage show us that we must reject it because it's not found in other Gospels. Yet most of these things can be found in Scripture. Do we see the disciples casting out demons? Yes. In Mark chapter 6, verses 7 through 13, we read of the disciples doing that very thing, casting out demons. Do we see the disciples speaking in new tongues? Absolutely. Acts chapter 2, verses 4 and 11, we find that very thing happening on the day of Pentecost, where they did speak in tongues. Other people were able to hear them in their own language. Do we see the disciples taking up serpents? Well, in Luke chapter 10, verse 19, the Lord told them that they would be able to trample on serpents and scorpions, meaning they would have power over those beasts. And we find it in Acts when Paul is shipwrecked and he's putting some sticks in a fire, a viper comes and bites him on the arm, and he just shakes it off. And people were amazed. Well, remember, they said the others sat and watched for him to start to, you know, I guess swell up or, you know, whatever the venom would have done to him, and he was fine. So we do have examples of that. Do we see the disciples laying hands on the sick and healing them? Of course. In Acts chapter 9, we actually even find Peter raising Dorcas from the dead, or Tabitha. It's the same person either. And so they were able to do these things. But the only one we don't have an actual biblical example of was them drinking anything deadly. And so because of that, that pushes this. That's just, well, they do these four, but they didn't do this fifth, and so we can't believe in this statement. That's an argument people will make. And these are the reasons why people have discounted these verses. In the other Gospels, we don't see Jesus rebuking his disciples after the resurrection. We don't see the apostles intentionally picking up serpents and drinking poisons. And further, these two older manuscripts don't carry it, so we have to ignore it. While these things may be a challenge and are undoubtedly different from the other Gospels, I believe we can make reasonable explanation that of the supposed difficulties we read in Mark, that we can believe in them. And one way we can do that is by looking at an account that's found in another Gospel that's not found in the others. John chapter 21 is very unique in the sense of the account that we find in John chapter 21. And so, if you want to turn along with chapter 21, I'm going to read, I think I've got four or five passages here that I want to focus on. Beginning in verse 4. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, and the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Here we read, they had just come in from a night of fishing, and they hadn't caught anything, and this is, I think, where Jesus tells them to put their nets down, and they pull them up, and there were so many fish. But the resurrection had already happened by this point. And the fact that Jesus had shown himself to the disciples immediately, we're told here in verse 4 that they didn't recognize that it was him. We go down to verse 7. That disciple whom Jesus loved, therefore, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. Here we read that when Peter found out it was Jesus, he was excited, and he dressed himself and went up to meet him. We don't have this account in any other of the Gospels. Verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." Here we read Jesus asking Peter if he loved him. And this happens three different times after Jesus responds with, "Feed my lambs," or "sheep." The story occurs nowhere else in any of the other Gospels. Verse 18, Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk where you wanted. But when you were old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." Here Jesus is making a prophecy about what would happen to Peter when he was older, that his death would not be one that Peter would want, that it was not a natural death, that he was going to be led to his death. We don't find this account in any other of the Gospels. And then verse 25, "Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." And so here we read a statement that is not found in any of the other Gospels, indicating there were plenty of things that Jesus did that none of the Gospels accounted for, and maybe only one Gospel did and the other three ignored. And so this verse here in John is saying there are things that happened that not everybody is going to be able to provide that account. And so we could apply that to the other Gospels based upon these five verses that we just reviewed, that we don't throw out John 21. We don't reject it because of its uniqueness. And the reason why is because it is found in all the other manuscripts. Even though it's unique, people do not have an issue with it. And so there are unique events and perplexing stories, but no one rejects this passage. But yet people are compelled to reject the ending of chapter 16 in the book of Mark. It's no less unique or really less amazing than what we find in the account in John 21. The only difference is that the Mark account is missing in some manuscripts. And so we have to understand, why should we reject Mark 16:9-20? But there really is no good reason to reject it based upon external evidences and internal evidences. Another argument that people make about these is that it's incomplete. That if we read only 1-8, that would be incomplete. That would be an argument against why 9-20 should be included. Mark 16, the first 8 verses, it's obvious that the story would not make sense if we stopped at the end of verse 8. And Mark is in the middle of discussing the resurrection story of Jesus. And we are to believe that verse 8 is at the end of the account. There has to be more. It doesn't make much sense. Because in verse 7, the man which the woman found sitting on the right side of the tomb gives the three women a command to go to tell the disciples and Peter that Jesus would go ahead of them and be meeting them in Galilee. The account would make no sense if it was to end right there. There would have been no need to mention this part if there wasn't a point where Jesus did meet them in Galilee and would pick up the story. And so we wouldn't know what happened in Galilee, and there would have been no reason for this to have been included there. And so to suggest that we should stop at verse 8 doesn't make much sense. There would be no point for that to even be included in the Gospels. But since Mark 16, verses 9-20, as I believe, is the inspired Word of God, as proved by thousands of other manuscripts, many want to know how can we understand verses 15-18. That's probably the most difficult portion of this. Even sound Christians may read these verses and wonder how it applies to us today, or should it apply to us today. And that is the part where it's talking about the signs that would accompany those who believe. And so we have to understand, ask ourselves, is who are those that believe? The most natural understanding is to go back to verse 16, where it says that those who believe and are baptized shall be saved. But since there are commentators and preachers and scholars who suggest that since we don't have these powers, that those who believe must refer to the apostles, that these are the signs and the powers that only the apostles would have. Well, that seems to get us out of our difficulty, and it might appease some of our friends that may be questioning us about these, but really it doesn't make any sense in the passage. Verse 17 is a general description that those who believe could not refer to the 11, as we know that they believed. The very phrase suggests that there were some who would believe and some who would not believe. To reference back to verse 14 is, well, no pun intended, it's off the mark. Further, were the apostles the only one who exhibited these signs? Absolutely not. In Acts 6, verse 8, it tells us that Stephen, full of grace and power, was doing great wonders and signs among the people. He was not an apostle. In Acts 8, we read of Philip performing miracles and casting out unclean spirits. Now, while there was an apostle named Philip, this is not the same Philip. This is Philip the evangelist. And he was casting out these unclean spirits while not being an apostle. In Acts 9, Ananias heals Saul of the blindness that he had after he had met Jesus on the road to Damascus. Ananias was not an apostle, but yet he was able to heal Saul. And based upon what we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 14, there were obviously members of the church at Corinth who had these passages. I mean, had these gifts to do these miracles. And so we could point out others, but these examples should be enough for us to see that the belief could not only be pointing to the apostles, and that they would be the only ones to have the ability to perform these acts. What we really are left with is the most natural reading, that verse 17 is referring to those who believe and are baptized. And then here are the signs for those people that believe and are baptized. Now, these gifts and these signs that were given to them were only needed in the first century. They were needed to validate the words they were speaking, because at that time there was no written word. And so, in verse 8, when Philip went into I think it was Samaria, and he's preaching, he had to perform these signs because there was no other way to prove what he was saying was true. But by doing these acts, they had to that would give him reason for them to not question what he was doing. And so, I believe we can understand this passage to be saying that those who believed and were baptized in the first century would receive some spiritual gifts based upon their belief. And in 1 Corinthians, as I referenced, we do find examples of people who were able to perform miracles. We could see some that were prophesying and some that were speaking in tongues. And there were many other gifts that were performed there. But we have to note that nothing in Mark 16, 17 through 18 suggests that these signs would go on endlessly, that this would be something that would always be available to us. And so when combined with other passages about the ending of spiritual gifts, most notably once again in 1 Corinthians, it mentions that when the completed word would come, when that which was perfect would come, these would not be needed anymore. And so when you look at verses 17 and 18 in Mark 16, and then you understand that later in 1 Corinthians it says these gifts will go away once the written word has come, then we can understand exactly why these don't apply to us today. But they were given at that time because it was a very important part of substantiating the words they were saying as they went through and visited and taught. There's the 1 Corinthians. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. And so we must understand that, yes, in the first century, those who obeyed the gospel and believed could receive these gifts, but it was not something that went on in perpetuity. And so as I conclude, I just want to mention why it is that I believe that most scholars and teachers want us to ignore verses 9 through 20, and it's because of what is found in verse 16. Verse 16 requires belief and baptism. And for whatever reason, most people in the religious world don't want to teach that. They don't want to preach baptism as essential as belief. And so anyone that wants to believe this, well, we have to cast doubt on this passage. We have to have some reason to bring doubt into the equation. And they do that by saying, well, out of all these thousands, this handful of manuscripts don't include it, so we should ignore it all. Yet in these verses, clearly Mark is teaching that salvation only comes about through belief and baptism. It's impossible to find salvation and to receive salvation through belief alone. And to eliminate this condition for salvation, all this text is just thrown into question and cause people to ignore it. And so that's why people want this out. Even in early centuries, people realized that they wanted to not have baptism be part of the equation. But the evidence that we talked about this morning shows that this text does belong, shows that belief and baptism is essential to salvation, and that we are able to make sense and understand this text naturally as to fit with the other Gospels and the message that it provides. So, with this in mind, I hope I've laid out a good enough argument that if you've ever wondered why in your translations it indicates that these verses might be ignored, I hope I've provided enough evidence to you to understand the real reason why people are ignoring it, not based upon actual reasons. And so that leaves us with one question. If you're here this morning and you haven't found salvation, you haven't, maybe you've believed, but if you haven't been baptized, these verses here in Mark chapter 16 clearly tell us that you must do both. That belief alone will not get you into heaven. Salvation only comes after believing the word and then acting upon it by being buried in the waters of baptism and rising a new creature out of those waters. And if you're here this morning and you have already made that commitment and you've done those acts, but you are struggling with your faith, you're struggling with staying faithful, and you have issues, we can help you with that as well. You can come forward and you can make those challenges known and we can pray for you. So whether you've made that decision or not, you have the opportunity this morning that you can come forward and you can make those known and we can help you in any way that you need. If you're subject to the invitation, I ask and implore you to come forward now as we stand and as we sing.